ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melanie Zederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Friday, March 1st, 2019. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, good afternoon, Melody.
Well, we couldn't pay much attention to Punxsutawney Phil. He let us down as far as his prediction of spring. So maybe coming in, it's a little bit of a lion today for March 1st. So maybe we'll go out like a lamb. We'll have some better weather by the end of March.
Hey, let's
what do you
hope.
Think?
I like the sound of it.
Do you think that's possible? Do you think? I think spring will really be on its way, but you've been getting a lot of snow. There's a lot of snow going up through the Northeast, and I guess another storm is coming through here in the middle of next week. So we've been fortunate. We just have rain, but temperatures are cool, quite cool. And temperatures for gold was quite cool today. And again, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I think I mentioned just earlier this week, it would be difficult to see gold break 1300 again, but we can't ever underestimate their power, their ability to manipulate. I think probably there had to have been a huge trade somewhere along the line today in order to have this type of an impact on gold today. We had gold fall more than 1%. It's the lowest level since January. It's actually their biggest weekly decline in more than 1.5 years. We had the dollar strengthen. You have the global stocks advancing. And so it was a hard day. And I find it hard to believe that with just that little bit of news that I just said, as far as dollar strengthening to the little that it did and the global stocks advancing as little as they did, that we'd have this big of an impact on gold. So we had the dollar strengthen, the index got stronger, the two-year treasury yields have moved up over the last couple of days. And I think too, Dave, I don't know if we have anything about this to talk about today, but the if you take a look at some of the treasuries and so forth and the inversion, again, they're indicating recessions even closer today than they were a little bit ago. Now, we had huge treasury auctions this week, I think to the tune of, if I remember correctly, $234 billion. The highest was earlier this year, or late last year, of $294 billion was the highest in a week of auctions of the treasury. So, you know, perhaps that had a little bit of an impact on it. We're going to talk about the gross domestic product yesterday, boosted treasury yields a little bit. And let's see if there was anything else before we get into the Spider Gold Trust, the SPDR, which is the world's largest gold-backed exchange-traded fund. That fell yesterday to the lowest since late December. So, again, you know, there's talk about strikes in South African mines. They says could keep the price of gold this high. I don't think that's the only impact that was keeping the price of gold higher. The strikes have been forestalled by the Court of South Africa. This threat still does exist. And, you know, but that is pretty much more in relationship both to platinum and palladium. So I don't know. It's a mixed bag. And I didn't really see any one indicator to give me to say, yes, this is what happened. Now, Monday, maybe we'll have a little bit of an idea on what trade took gold down $21.90. The New York spot price, aftermarket at $1,292. That was down 1.67%. Silver was down 2.75%, down 43 at $15.24. Platinum was still down $14 at $860. Palladium was up 2 at $1,549. Now the USDX was still below 97 at 96.50. Up 0.28. So, you know, that wasn't that jarring in order to have this type of an impact on the gold pricing. Crude oil was down 1.44 at 55.78. And let me go ahead and get to the paper markets today. The Dow, last time I saw it, was up triple digits. 110, 26,026. NASDAQ was up 62 at 7,595. The S&P up 19 at 2,803. Let's see. I did read a headline earlier today that maybe they're going to begin limiting buybacks. There was a White House economist. I'm not sure if that was Kudlow or not, but they might be limiting buybacks. Well, we'd see, what would happen in there. But we did have a nice bump in the 10-year yield, 2.76%, up 0.04. So that's been rising. Remember, Dave, it was just, 2.6, Friday a week ago. Mm-hmm. So, that's up quite a bit for the week. Japan was up a little over 1%. Emotion is driving the market, fear and greed. We're at 74. Remember December, we were at 6, 5. We have such short memories. But how quickly things can change. And it's like, what really did change? To me, things are far worse today than they were in December. You have a tentative agreement falling apart with North Korea. Still no, the expiration March 1st for China, that's here and gone today. No new tariffs have been put on, but still, we're no closer to any type of agreements. We have more reports today of things, personal incomes, manufacturing, we're going to talk about here in a little bit. And, the stocks are the paper markets are still trying to show the best showing in a long time. Over the past year and a half, we've had an extremely wide price range, and the extremes become more extreme to the upside and the downside. And this is from Sven Henrik. He's with. He's some technical expert with some company. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, for example, rallied the beginning of 2018 on the passing of tax cuts, again in the summer and then in the past 2 months. And at some point, these patterns get too extreme, and then something triggers it. Volatility moves higher, and then we break to the downside. And again, I get that this is a lot of the, robo-trading or whatever you want to call it, the algorithmic trading. Taken a lot of emotion out of these markets, certainly taken any war premiums out of these markets. When we look at all these countries that are about ready to hit each other on their head with their nuclear weapons, Dave.
Yeah, how about it? Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that too. And we'll also talk later in the show about at least one person's perspective on these extreme ups and downs being tied to large pension plans, and how that could be affecting some of this crazy movement. In the meantime, we know now that the major sell-off just a few months ago at the end of 2018 pushed the Dow to the edge of a bear market. Since its December 26th bottom, that index has bounced back 19% and sits around 1,000 points from its record high. All these rallies have massive gap ups, meaning that a lot of open gaps were not filled and there's been no retesting yet. And so far, rally since the December lows has not been tested technically in any shape or form, and like others, we do expect some sort of test to take place this month. Though the Dow slightly lower for the week, it ended last Friday with its longest weekly win streak since 1995, and an even longer longer term S&P 500 chart stretching back to the mid 90s. Gives an early indication that conditions might go from bad to worse. I should say from good to bad to worse. Melody.
Yeah, there's certainly an extreme volatility. And to me, when you see that type of volatility in these markets, these are not good signs. These are not good signs. And it just goes to show how dangerous these markets are. And again, we go back to David Stockman, and he's there, get out, get out, get out. And we have saw personal incomes for the first time in more than 3 years in January. You had dividends and interest payments drop. We've had, which they dropped, pointing to a moderate growth in consumer spending after it fell by the most since 2009 in December. The Commerce Department said this morning that personal income slipped 0.1% in January, and that was the first decline since November of 2015. And income was weighed down by decreases in dividend, farm proprietors, and interest income. Wages increased 0.3% in January after rising 0.5% in December. So you had a lot of you had economists that were polled by Reuters. They had forecast incomes rising 0.3% in January, but the Commerce Department didn't publish the January consumer spending portion of the report. And you, ladies and gentlemen, you all know why. It was all because of the 35-day government shutdown in January. They just don't know how to catch up like real people do. But
you know, it reported that consumer spending, which accounts for more than two-thirds of GDP, dropped 0.5% in December, and that was the biggest decline since September 2009, and followed a 0.6% increase the month before. Now, households cut back on purchases of motor vehicles and recreational goods in December, leading to a nearly 2% plunge in spending on goods, while outlays on services edged up 0.1%, held back by a decline in spending on household electricity and gas. Now, the data was included in the fourth quarter GDP report that was published yesterday, which, as Melody reported, showed consumer spending growing at a 2.8% annualized clip during that period. That was slower than the third quarter's 3.5% pace. The economy grew at a 2.6% rate in the fourth quarter after notching 3.4% in the third.
And again, they tell us that inflation remains benign in December. The personal consumption expenditures price index, excluding food and energy, rose 0.2% after a similar gain in November. Blah, blah, it goes on and on. Well, and these reports are almost laughable anymore, you know.
You know, it's tempting not to even mention the PCE, you know, any price index that excludes two of the most probably heavily weighted expenditures of, you know, I got to believe it's a majority of households, it doesn't make sense at all. I mean, you say it's 1.9% excluding, you know, the volatile food and energy components? Well, then it's not 1.9%. it lacks credibility, Melody.
Welcome to the world of government numbers, and change that equation to make it work. And we're going to use that because, you know, hey, people use food and energy. And man, if we had inflation closer to where it should be, like probably what right now, if you even got a little bit of clothes, we'd be looking about what, 8% maybe, you know, inflation. And they certainly can't control the government with, you know, if they let people think that inflation is any higher than what they project it to be. But, you know, we talked a little bit earlier this week about Payless shoe stores. That's a big deal, Dave. And there's another recent wave of store closure announcements that's going to be hitting these shopping malls all across the U.S. You're going to have hundreds of storefronts that are going to be empty. And, of course, hundreds, if not thousands, of people unemployed. Victoria's Secret said it's going to shut about 50 locations in 2019 when it normally closes closer to a dozen each year. Gap said it's closing 230 of its namesake brand stores over a two-year span. JCPenney, they announced they plan to shut 18 department stores and 9 of its furniture and home locations in 2019. You know, then we're going to build on take those, and that builds on these recent store closures. As I mentioned, Payless Shoe Store, you have Gymboree, you have Charlotte Russe, Ann Taylor. 4,309 store closures were announced by retailers just in the first 2 months of this year.
Yeah, that's well ahead of the number of announcements this particular tracking firm was following the same time a year ago. Even Tesla this week said it plans to move all its sales online and close showrooms, which is quite unusual for car sales. If anything, this gentleman, Jay Niffen, who's CEO of this consulting firm, J. Rogers Niffen Worldwide, if anything, he said, this increases my concerns for the malls. He said there are roughly 1,200 malls in the U.S. and only 250 great ones that aren't in trouble right now. He thinks, we're going to see, the fact we're going to see more store closures this year than last spells big trouble for a lot of these remaining malls, Melody.
I know last year they were projected to have, 8,000 retail stores close, storefronts. I don't know if we hit that number or not, but if we did hit that number, that means we're halfway there already in the first 2 months to beat last year's record. I mean, those are some incredible numbers. You know what's interesting, Dave?
What?
Yesterday I read that PepsiCo.
Mm-hmm.
Great numbers. Great numbers. Lots of profit. Profits are up. Everything's up, 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 up. They're looking to close stores. They're going to streamline. And I think what they're doing is they're converting a lot to technology, automation. Maybe this is what we're seeing. I don't know if we're seeing this in all these retail stores, but in some of these businesses, maybe that's now whether, and I don't think PepsiCo is going to sell everything online like some of your retail stores are. But instead of these companies, they're doing, if the economy is doing better, they're doing better, then why are they laying off people? Well, they want to cut out the pensions. They want to cut, the pensions that they're obligated to. They're going to have early retirements because it's cheaper for them to pay off these early retirements and severance pay than it is to pay the pensions. So that's what they're getting at. That's what they're doing. And streamline, the manufacturing process with automation. So, hey, who thinks that when the economy is doing great that you'd still continue to see layoffs and store closures? We're heading into our break, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Going into the break, we were talking a little bit about the malls, the retail, and now we have U.S. manufacturing that expanded at a slower than expected pace last month. It's reached its lowest level in more than 2 years. The ISM Manufacturing Index slipped to 54.2 in February from 56.6 in January. Economists polled by this company expected the index to slip to 55.5 in February. The index's print was also the weakest since November of 2016, and a decline in new orders, production, employment, and prices all contributed to the broader index's decline. And consumption in the form of production and employment continued to expand but fell a combined 8.9 points from the previous month's levels. When are they going to release the numbers for jobs? Dave, next week?
That came out today. Some of it came out today. Not the number of jobs added, but we talk about that soon, I think, after this next story.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about the employment. We also have William Dudley, former New York Fed president, had a message for Wall Street: stop blaming the central bank when the stock market declines. Dudley retired in 2018, and he said yesterday that the Federal Reserve's actions have become a convenient whipping boy. Well, I don't know about that. They're pretty much, they were in charge of this whole thing ever since Greenspan. I mean, they're part of the creation of the granddaddy of all bubbles here that we're ready to face. So, I don't know what he's, I guess they're all protecting themselves, but many traders blame the late 2018 market tailspin on the Fed's balance sheet runoff. The runoff is expected to end later this year with the balance sheet at around $3.7 trillion, and reducing the balance sheet like hiking interest rates acts as a tightening measure on the economy.
Yeah, I mean, after hiking rates four times last year and initially projecting two hikes for this, the Fed held steady at its January meeting, the Federal Open Market Committee meeting, and the Powell Fed said it would be patient in determining further moves this year and next. Now, Dudley says the Fed has always been data dependent. He also argued that five things happened to change the policymakers' minds between October and January. He says, number one, financial conditions tightened in the fourth quarter quite significantly, according to him. Number two, despite strong payroll growth, the unemployment rate stopped declining. Number three, the tightness in the labor market didn't lead to much wage acceleration. Four, inflation was a little bit in the soft side. And five, there were questions about global growth, particularly in China and Europe. Now, he says none of those factors alone would have changed the Fed's stance, but all of them together pointed to more downside risk in the economy. So I guess he's saying, stop whining, Wall Street. We're just trying to do our jobs. Mm. Well, consumers, you step it up. The heck with Wall Street firms. I mean, in this case, it's certainly self-interested, this level of complaining. But consumers, households, You know, you're what drive the economy. You stay tuned in and speak up and be heard.
You know, day one in five U.S. corporations say Chinese stole their IP last year. Five in North American-based corporations on the CNBC Global CFE Council said they have stolen their intellectual property. In all, seven of the 23 companies surveyed, or 30% of the Chinese firms, have stolen from them over the past 10 years. And this survey was conducted between February 7th and February 22nd. And Lighthizer, the U.S. trade rep, Robert Lighthizer, said the other day that a deal with China must not only include more Chinese purchases of U.S. products, but enforcement. And, you know, I just come back to the mind is, how do these companies let them steal it? Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Do they hack? Well, then why aren't these companies doing what's needed to be done to protect the hacking? Or if China is saying, well, if you want to do business in here, you need to give us this, is that stealing?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. And it is the latter. I mean, not to say that, you know, there haven't been hacks before to steal those secrets. But here's a case that, as you alluded to, there's a condition of doing business in that country. Non-Chinese companies are required, as that condition, to provide the state with those secrets, you know, whether they, you know, be patents or whatever. And, you know, so, you know, it's characterize it how you wish. I guess it's not traditional theft, but if that's the only way you're doing business, you know, these companies have decided obviously that the benefit to their balance sheets of doing business there outweigh the harm done by giving away the secrets. Yes? No? It seems that way.
So then my question is, why isn't our government going after the corporations saying, you can't do that? So if that means you can't do business in China, you've got a ton of other third world countries you can do business in, or bring that business back to the United States. You know?
Yeah, I know. I guess it's not that simple. I mean, a lot of them are already doing business here. This is just another market, a newer market, a less tapped market. And obviously, you know, with the population and with China still being in a growth mode, albeit, you know, less than what it has been over the last decade, these U.S. and other non-Chinese corporations have made the calculated decision to go ahead. Now, you know, I'm not sure that if they're looking to have it, to have their cake and eat it too. You know, again, however you calculate it, yes, they're consciously, in the vast majority of cases, giving up the information that China, the Chinese state has demanded. And
you know, I look at it this way. Isn't this a little day late? Too short and a day late? I mean, I would think that most of your major intellectual property that was given to China has been given to them in the past 25 years. You know, and you know, you know, so how much more do they, you know? I mean, technology and so forth, I'm sure they're now in a place to, you know. So, as you see where I'm going with that one?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but I hear you. I mean, some of these patents are so specialized.
Yeah.
However, I guess that's where the devil resides. Mm-hmm. in this respect.
Well, you know, Romania wants to repatriate its gold. Let's get back to gold for a little bit. Not only do central banks want more gold, but they want their own gold back. They want to hold it in their own vaults. Now, this is according to international reports. Romania is the latest nation that wants its gold back. The Romania Social Democrat Party leader, Divu Drognea, and Senator Serbin Nicolae have proposed legislation that requires the National Bank of Romania to hold its or most of its gold reserves domestically. Now, a description of the bill posted on the Senate's website said the National Bank of Romania can deposit gold from the established reserve abroad exclusively for the purpose of obtaining income through trading and other specific operations. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you, we've been talking about Basel III. That is going into effect by March 31st. Now, is this part of getting their gold back so their banks can carry their gold in their Tier 1 as they are now required to do? Is this all part of the timing for this is kind of interesting. It'll be interesting to see if we have more central banks, regardless of the size, if they're going to be doing this. So,
I think that's a very insightful comment. I'm not sure we can know for sure at this point, but certainly you think about other things being equal. Boy, what a way to be able to meet those requirements, fulfill that legal obligation.
Absolutely.
Without having to go out and raise, in many cases, probably, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
So, I don't know. Is there actually coincidences in politics and banking? I don't think so. But anyway.
Well, it is interesting in this in this case, Melody. I mean, the National Bank of Romania does keep some of its some gold in its vaults in Bucharest, but the majority of it is reportedly held in the UK with the Bank of England. So the proposed legislation that you mentioned has been filed for debate in the Senate under their urgent procedures. The senator said nothing in Romania's economic situation justifies keeping such a quantity of gold in reserve abroad with the associated costs when this reserve can be kept and supplemented accordingly in deposits in the country. However, the central bank governor has pushed back on the proposed legislation. You know, he said, I've been accused that I keep the reserves abroad as if I'm the one to keep them, as if they were mine. Where do you want us to keep them? These are international reserves, he said. Do you think the euros and the dollars are kept in BNR's basement? They are kept in reserves, he was quoted as saying.
We know they currently hold about 103 tons of gold in the reserves, valued at about $3.84 billion. And, of course, some commodity analysts have pushed back on the idea of central banks repatriating their gold, a theme that has been gaining traction for the last couple of years. So analysts have noted that moving gold away from any market hubs like New York and London can create logistical problems if that precious metal ever needs to be monetized. And that's probably why they want to move their gold back to their homeland. But Romania's move comes after an active year for central banks in the gold market. And according to the World Gold Council, central banks collectively bought 651 tons of gold in 2018. And that's the most purchases in more than 50 years.
Impressive. Impressive. Well, talking about banks, Melody, one of our least favorites of the too big to fails, Wells Fargo, has reached a record $240 million settlement with U.S. shareholders over the creation by bank employees of millions of unauthorized customer accounts. The settlement was disclosed late yesterday. It requires insurers for 20 current and former Wells Fargo executives and executives, including CEO Tim Sloan and his predecessor John Stumpf, to pay the $240 million to the bank. It resolved claims that the officials breached their fiduciary duties by knowing about or consciously disregarding the bogus accounts and failing to stop their creation. Now, the officials denied wrongdoing and agreeing to the settlement filed with the federal court in San Francisco, where Wells Fargo is located. Lawyers for the shareholders called the accord the largest insurer-funded cash settlement in a U.S. shareholder derivative lawsuit, surpassing News Corp's $139 million accord 6 years ago over its handling of that phone hacking scandal in the U.K.
Well, you know, last year at about this time, some Wall Street hedge fund managers were practically chomping at the bit for the momentum rally to finally end. There were several managers that told these investors their quarterly letters that the markets were doing the opposite of what they should have been doing. So what's behind all of these dramatic changes? At least this is what these analysts have to offer up to explain to their clients. But it's kind of interesting because this one is suggesting that maybe pension funds may be to blame for the extremes that they've witnessed in recent years. Brian Reynolds, he's an analyst for Canaccord, weighed in on a bill to limit share purchases that was introduced in the U.S. Senate last month. Okay, this legislation would limit share repurchases and said that some investors were concerned because debt-fueled buybacks had been the major catalyst for the bull market for the past 10 years. Reynolds thinks that the share buyback will probably won't be enacted for at least a few years, but if it ever is, he believes it would contribute to a record strong LBOs that would propel stocks higher until the next financial crisis.
Yeah, now Reynolds believes the problem is essentially unregulated pension funds, which he says have driven repeated financial boom and bust cycles since the early 1990s. Here's why he thinks pension funds are to blame. He says the problem is that our nation's public pensions have become the dominant global investor. They're grossly underfunded, and thus they have to reach for risk and are essentially unregulated because of states' belief that they're sovereign, mm-hmm. all 50 state pension plans. And in the case of a state like Pennsylvania, which has literally a couple of thousand municipal police and non-police pension funds, all independently, I shouldn't say all, some fall under the state plan, but by and large, the vast majority are individually operated. Crazy stuff, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll touch on this when we come back from the break. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight?
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen. And we want to welcome you into the program, and make sure you visit the website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. Make sure you sign up for a weekly newsletter. And for all your gold and silver coin needs, of course, we are here for you. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, your support of Discount Gold and Silver, we're very competitive. Our prices match anyone online, and a lot of the profits go back into programs to support Pastor Butch Paul, Beth Ann, Greg Hunter, and several other ones out there. So you do a lot when you purchase from Discount Gold and Silver. We're going to continue on with the pension plans and about this analyst, and he believes that these buybacks, we're talking about the buybacks and the pension plans, that the buybacks are just a symptom of pensions needing, or the pensions need for returns. And as a result, even if lawmakers do end up limiting buybacks at some point, it wouldn't do anything to treat pension funds' needs for outsized returns. Reynolds expects the Treasury and government agency yield curves to invert within the next 1 or 2 years. He says when that happens, like other modern credit cycles, the money that banks have becomes unprofitable. So it will then be shifted towards financing a wave of leveraged buyouts, which could last as long as 2 years. And this result would be a surge in stock prices before a run on the shadow banking systems prompts another financial disaster. And unless politicians and regulators can change the behavior of public pensions, which we know they're not going to, we think another boom and bust lies ahead. And you know what, Dave? I think he's spot on in explaining this, except for one thing, is his timing. I think the bust lies ahead. I think we're in that boom. And there's not going to be another boom. I don't think we've never experienced a bust in order to be in another boom. I don't consider, you know, the end of last year a bust. So I think we're closer to it than what he is suggesting that we are.
Yeah, indeed. You know, going back overseas for a moment, Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, has had quite the week after leaving Hanoi, Vietnam, following end of the summit point two with between President Trump and Chairman Kim. Pompeo said today that the U.S. is committed to ensuring the South China Sea remains open to all kinds of navigation, and that China does not pose a threat of closing the disputed sea lanes. Now, he made that statement and assured the Philippines during a visit today to Manila that America will come to its defenses if its forces, aircraft or ships, come under armed attack in the South China Sea. And that's the first such public U.S. assurance in recent memory. Pompeo's comments were an attempt to address Philippine concerns over the vagueness of the Allies' 1951 Mutual Defense Treaty, which Manila is looking to have re-examined. Washington will back the Philippines and other countries in the region, quote, so that these incredibly vital economic sea lanes are open and China does not pose a threat to closing them down. That was Pompeo once more.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about this on yesterday's program about India and Pakistan, and your latest blog, and which listeners can, you know, subscribe to if they go to the website, is about the growing tensions in Asia.
Yeah, Melody, geopolitical volatility really ramped up this week in several corners of the world. But the one story that was getting most of my attention going into the weekend surrounds nuclear-armed neighbors India and Pakistan. You know, the border countries with a history of, a long history, decades of fighting each other, dating back to at least the post-World War II, came closer to the precipice of another war this week than they have been in decades, and the threat has yet to wane. Now, as many listeners may have read by now, the crisis began with a Valentine's Day attack by a group, a militant group in Pakistan called JEM that killed 40 Indian military police in the disputed region of Kashmir. India responded with airstrikes on Balakot in Pakistan, crossing the line of control that divides the two countries. And that was for the first time since 1971. Pakistan then launched a retaliatory strike earlier this week, downing an Indian plane and capturing an Air Force pilot, who they have since made arrangements to turn back over to India. But Pakistan's Prime Minister, Imran Khan, followed up with a conciliatory speech asking India's Narendra Modi to come to the table for talks, including about terrorism.
Well, maybe it was a good thing that the U.S. was preoccupied with North Korea's nuclear disarmament this week, and basically the world has largely left it up to these two countries to resolve this crisis. That might be a good thing.
Yeah, how about it? You know, geez, I mean, that's true. You know, Modi, however, does face pressure to act quickly and decisively in the lead-up to India's May elections. However, many observers agree it's hard to see how another round of escalation would benefit his endgame, especially given Pakistan's willingness to retaliate as it has done this week and many times before. Analysts speculate that if Khan and Modi do meet, Modi might ask for Pakistan to take concrete permanent steps against JEM, as well as other militant groups in that country.
Isn't that the hard part, Dave?
Well, it is. You know, Pakistan's military has never been willing to root out these groups completely anyway, because they give the country leverage to maintain a semblance of, you know, power, power parity with India. Now, Khan made the announcement in an address to both houses of his parliament, saying he tried to reach Modi on Wednesday with a message that he wants to de-escalate tensions. An Indian government official, however, warned that even if the pilot is returned home, New Delhi would not hesitate to launch a preemptive strike if it feared a similar militant attack was looming. Khan also said Wednesday night that he feared that that India might launch a missile attack anyway, but the situation was later diffused somewhat. Meanwhile, fresh skirmishes erupted yesterday and were reportedly continuing this morning's early hours between Indian and Pakistani soldiers, that according to the Associated Press, which was along the so-called line of control that divides disputed Kashmir between the two rivals.
Is it true that the Pakistani soldiers were targeting nearly two dozen points in India with mortar and gunfire?
That's what we read. I mean, an Indian Army spokesperson called it an unprovoked violation of the 2003 ceasefire accord between the two countries. He said Indian soldiers were responding to ongoing Pakistani attacks along the highly militarized frontier. India acknowledged that one of its MiG-21s, which, boy, we haven't heard that in a while, that's a Soviet era fighter jet, was lost in skirmishes with Pakistan. India's Ministry of External Affairs said late Wednesday that it strongly objected to Pakistan's vulgar display of an injured personnel of the Indian Air Force and that it expects his immediate and safe return.
Well, you know, Kashmir has been divided but claimed by its entirety by both India and Pakistan, as you mentioned, since 1947.
Yeah, this is interesting to read more about. I mean, they've fought three wars against each other, two directly dealing with the disputed region. Both Indian and Pakistani officials reported small arms fire and shelling along the Kashmir region into, I guess that was yesterday morning. Authorities in Pakistani-controlled Kashmir closed all schools and educational institutions in the region, and they urged parents to keep their children at home amid mounting tension with India. Now, interestingly, Pakistan's foreign minister also said that Saudi Arabia's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs planned to come to Islamabad with an urgent message from Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Now, we'll keep listeners abreast of any updated news on that front in the coming week. Meanwhile, Modi, in his first remarks since the pilot's capture, gave a rallying speech ahead of elections in the coming months. He said, "The country's facing challenging times, and it will fight, live, work, and win unitedly."
Mm. Yeah. Well, is the ball in Modi's court?
Well, it looks like it is. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how quickly, not to mention where and under what circumstances he'll agree to meet with Khan. Dave Lawler of Axios observed in this context that Modi's next step will largely determine whether these two nuclear-armed neighbors head for war or take a tentative step toward negotiations. Now, I, for one, expect to hear more about this growing tension in the coming days as Trump and his diplomacy team return home. I mean, call me cynical, but spinning this story at this point, I think, presents the White House with an opportunity to get the public's and media attentions off of this week's explosive, largely uncorroborated testimony by Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. It also gives Trump an opportunity, possibly, to play a hand in drawing down of tensions between the two countries.
Well, it was interesting today, and I guess this is a good thing, that South Korea's president said today that they're going to continue to work with the U.S. and North Korea to ensure that there is some sort of an agreement on denuclearization. As we all know, that the second summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un didn't work. And South Korea's President Moon Jae-in, and he has been an active supporter. In fact, as I said this many times in this program, when he was elected to office, this was his main goal. He wanted to open up the borders. So he really is. This means a lot to him and the country and the peninsula. They want to open up that pipeline from Russia down through North Korea down to South Korea. So it is important. That's their ultimate goal. So South Korea's President Moon has continued to be a supporter of efforts to end this confrontation on this peninsula. And so he's... he is the negotiator between the negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's that's, boy, what a challenging challenging task. Trump came home to say, that the 2 days of talks had made good progress, but he thought it was important not to rush into what he characterized as a bad deal. The U.S. essentially walked away because of unacceptable North Korean demands. It was all about the sanctions, he said in a news conference. North Korea sort of disputed it, that they were supposedly looking for just a partial lifting of sanctions, but whatever, the real story, it's certainly good to see that South Korea, who obviously is the largest benefactor in the Korean Peninsula, followed somewhat closely by Japan, it's in their best interest. And Moon Jae-in does seem to have struck up a real good relationship, at least on the face of it, with Kim and his inner circle. So we'll see what happens.
But this second summit could have all been a play in to manipulate Kim Jong-un. Because here now he's had a little bit of taste of importance with promises of economic growth he, you know, the carrot was dangled in front of him, and he was kind of like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then all of a sudden it was snatched away, walked away. So now what do you do? What does someone in that position usually do? He wants that carrot. So yeah, maybe it was a way to manipulate him into going the 100% denuclearization and so forth. So maybe it was part of the plan.
You got to believe that there will be no U.S. foreign aid approved by Congress, certainly the House, short of a, if not an immediate full denuclearization, at least a partial one that leads to an eventual full denuclearization that's completely verifiable. So you could be onto something there, Melody.
Well, hey. This morning, President Trump, the administration, they're beginning to put a little more pressure on Venezuela's President Maduro. They slapped sanctions on 6 high-ranking security officials in Venezuela for obstructing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The Treasury Department said the 6, including officials with the National Guard and police, are allied with Maduro. And, of course, he's closed Venezuela's borders. My question is, why wasn't this humanitarian aid going there a lot sooner than today? Anyway, we'll be back Monday. Thank you, Dave. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. Until then, we'll be back. Good night and
bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.